this balmy day. It feels really nice to be back in this part of the country. I was here this summer for most of August in New Harmony at the Scholars House that USI runs out there. And I didn't get a chance to come to USI and meet any of the students, but I did get to meet some of the faculty, so it's great to see them again. It's so nice to come and read in a place where there are some friendly faces out there. So hi, everybody. Hi, new friends, too. I'm looking forward to talking with you just a little bit at the end of the reading, if you want to do like a Q&A or something. I have two short pieces that I'm going to read. I should say, though, before I start, that it was a real honor to have been named the writer in residence at New Harmony and to be given a month in that house and in that place and in a town with maybe the only Twin Peaks themed coffee shop in the whole world. It was a real gift. I worked on my third book there, and I'll be forever grateful for that, and I can't wait to hopefully turn it into a book that will have USI somewhere in the acknowledgments for their incredible gift. So thank you very much, and thank you too to Ron and Casey for taking such good care of me when I was there and alone and didn't know how to cook. So thank you for all the brisket on my doorstep. Okay, so here's a couple of essays from my most recent book, which, as Casey said, is this collection of essays of animal celebrity. Not really like Paris Hill's dog or anything, but like moments in human history where we have named an animal and put them in the historical record in some way. Every single essay in the collection covers one of those animals. There are 15 of them in the book. It's modeled after a medieval bestiary, like a book of beasts, and they're chronologically arranged. The first one is this mammoth that fell out of the permafrost a couple years ago, but is 39,000 years old. Her name is Yuka, and it goes all the way through circus elephants and spiders in space. The first North American female in space was a spider named Arabella, who spun a web on Skylab in 1973. And it ends with this concept of de-extinction and the first animal that we humans ever successfully de-extinct, made non-extinct. But I think I'm going to read one full essay that's about 7 minute read, and then the snippets of another essay from much earlier in the book. This is the first essay that that I wrote for the book. When I found out that this bear had a name and that Shakespeare referenced it in his plays, it just really started me thinking about what kind of book I could make. So back in Elizabethan, I think there's something about being in this theater in the realm that's making me want to read this essay. You know Shakespeare, right? You heard of him, huh? Yeah, maybe. So he was a little bit of a competitive guy. He was a little bitchy in a way, and he had all these rivals. There were all these different entities that were vying for ticket sales from him back in the late 16th, early 17th century. And he references them in these kind of shady ways. He mentions Christopher Marlowe and As You Like It, he sort of half-heartedly references these children's theater performers in Hamlet. But the only person, or the only individual that he actually name-checks in his plays is this bear named Saperson, who fought a bunch of animals in this place called the Bear Garden, or a bear baiting ring, right next to the Globe Theater, in a building that was shaped identically to the Globe Theater, and not altogether unlike this building here, now that I think about it. Oh, kismet. Okay, so I think that's all you need to know. Saperson, this is Saperson. I wonder if I should try, let's see how this goes. Let's see if we can go. Well, now I have to do it. Okay. Saperson. The London garden, brackish and packed in, was hazy with a dozen kinds of flesh. The bulls, cocks, mastiffs, men, and chimpanzees, in air so rickety it lowered the roof. So dark, the line between crowd and beasts was marred. There, in that black, Sir Raleigh took his Frenchmen, and other men of duty met their spies. The reason for their famous fireworks, just so the folks who'd wagered bets could see. A rose of flames, pitched high above the crowd, fired smoke into the muck that hung about. It spun. It spat red bits around the seats.
They'd rig it to toss pears as it rotated. The fruit-mad crowd would then jump up and chase the rolling pears out to the bankside streets. Or yard boys, eager in their dirty gloves, would toss hot bread upon the patrons' laps, which made them clutch and scurry toward the exits. Outside, they'd find some other Sunday sport, an archery butt, a woman, or a play. The stews downriver had less fornication, and St. Bartholomew's floors less wet with blood. The bloody muzzle, or the mastiff's blood, the blood of fisticuffs up in the stands, the blood of offal floated down the Thames to Bayside from the abattoirs of town. And by the time the century turned around, it seemed the blood most often spilled was his. But do not think that London's garden crowd imagined him some broken, bashed-in thing. Believe me, this is tricky. I might see the lives of baited bears as nothing but a broken cord of muzzle, chain, and stake, of blunted teeth, barrages of dog jaws, of living out a mongrel just to have another thrown upon the slavered flesh. That rink's the only place that he could run, a hard-won constitutional, running laps and dodging bulls in that dank polygon, that garden, broken even in its flowers. The rosettes they affixed to his brow were bullseyes for the mastiffs when they jumped, and jump they did, mouths tearing at the flesh that leered at them from each side of the bloom. They bit so hard that London citizens grew up thinking a bear's eyes to be pink. A few years of that, he was too blind to fight. The bear word had to get creative then. Chain center, hunkered, lashed by volunteers until the blood ran rivers down his spine. Sometimes he'd raise his matted arms and gnash about the lash until it snapped in half. And once, he stooped low to the lazy knot, untied himself with effort from the stake, then nosed about the rink and backward loops it to hear the ladies scream. The bear would scramble. They dragged him off stage to his pit in cheers. For even then, mere lame and sightless, he could still throw 9-stone mastiffs to the crowds, up to the boxes, to the ladies' laps, bypassing pumpkin hose and straight to the skirts, like he could sniff a woman's quivering thigh and hurl the big dog head or tail right to her. A sniff, a twitch to shudder the dog spit, a fling, a lady's lap of going, ah! And then they'd add another dog, then three, till 6 or 7 mastiffs lined the rink, the sound more deafening since his sight was gone. God damn it if he wasn't still around. They could have put his picture on the money. Elizabeth, who never said hello, loved him enough to ban all Thursday sport. Upon the mildest Thursdays, he'd parade out past the playhouse, down the London Bridge. He'd smell the ragmen, actors, punks in stews who yelled for him in right cacophony. The bulls in ribboned horns all marched behind. The cocks in boxes and the dogs behind. The only bear who ever led the dogs. And even on his nights off, he appeared in name checks at the Hope, the Rose, the Globe, a dactyl in the mouths of water poets, the only rival Shakespeare called by name. In Johnson, in Act 5 at Dunsinane, at Middle Temple Hall on Candlemas, when Chambers' fairest boy in Fake Dubs crooned, have you not set mine honor at the stake and baited it with all the unmuzzled thoughts that tyrannous heart can think? So, it'd be wrong to match that bear with breaking. They lifted him up, they built him up, they called him out by name because they read in him a secret code both terrifying and recognizable. They read it in his stance, up on 2 legs, the 4 paws spread, the 10 claws digital. They saw it in his low-slung hips and gut, the way his pupils, round and beady, lived inside a circle of expressive white. And milliseconds prior to the bite, they saw it when he shut his eyes and sighed. What did they see? They saw themselves, of course. A taller man, more leaden and hirsute, with thick skin better suited for a beating, but still, their bear, this massive chestnut frame, dwarfed tiny by a darkened ring of foes. A smaller ratio of the ring itself dwarfed by the river flowing to their north, that lurid, pestilent Thames. 6 city plagues. The pox, the new ague, the curious sweats, all floated past their bear garden in leagues. A river of unprecedented sick. In 92, things got so royally poxed the playhouses were forced to shutter up. A quarter of their population down each decade, give or take 100 score. And a blighted age can make a garden blind. Each ticket holder turns left, right, behind, and wonders which part of that dark quartet will suffer an unnatural upset next. For when our clans explode up into towns, the backbite comes from nature, and it smarts. The devil holds back nature by its ears, takes aim, makes wager, then releases it. We toss it off, and it regenerates. 6 natural mouths leap up before we're primed. The parades of sickness cannot be explained by any learned clansmen, physics, priests. This inexplicable can send us toward an unplanned occupation with the self. And selves, like famous bears, are singular. We are soon switches places with I am. And then clans, bewitched by I ams, become crowns, which are an altogether different thing. He heard these I ams in the garden's roar. I am this bear, stuck in this blighted rink, beset upon by nature's ticking clock. I am not hunkered down in numbered packs. Instead, I am awaiting death alone. I am afraid of time's encroaching power. For each new year, I am more bluntly struck. I feel pain, feel it doubling, then I am it. I am always in wait of time's new teeth. And though befuddled, drunk on sick, I am unfit to tear my eyes away from him. The growl of him, his mighty swipe, his blood, the way he foams both in and out of ours. I know my chain of sickness would, I am sure, would be less if I could shake off minutes, break pain's spine, or send plague squealing to a bitch's lap. For even if I knew more time, more sick was at the go, it'd be a righteous salve to fight whatever hour's on me now, to discard the sick dog of what is now and shake it, a contaminated rag stained with the gusto of my intellect. Yes, I am jealous of his natural acts, and so I'll hit his nature with a stick. And that chipper essay is Sacrosanct.
Awesome. I was a lot scarier than I thought it was going to be, so I'm going to hide behind a curtain.
Although, if you are looking for the acoustic sweet spot, I do believe it's right about here. So
the next time there's a faculty meeting in here and you really want to be heard, just run.
Run up to right here. Okay, back where it's safe. Let me just check and see how I'm doing in time. Do I have 7 more minutes?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So one of the things that I noticed when you put together a collection of animals is, and you're researching sort of the history of the way that humans have made animals famous, very few of the stories end happily. So I wanted this book to be the kind of, like an essay in itself. So there's like 15 separate essays, but they make this kind of larger thing, like a concept album almost. And it was like all of the songs on the concept album were like total downers. The other thing that I noticed when I was about halfway through putting the book together is that most of the animals I was finding were mammals and were quadrupeds. So at a certain point I had to find a happy story and it needed to be like a bug or a bird or something. So I found this guy. Mozart, you guys know him, right? We don't know very much about his life, surprisingly. It seems like we do because people always make movies about him and plays and stuff, but we really don't know, and we, you know, listen to his, every time you sing the ABCs, you're singing one of his compositions, right? Or Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. Or Baa Baa Black Sheep. One of the things that we do know, because he was that he spent money too much, because he died in a pauper's grave. And at one point in his life, somebody asked him to start writing down everything he purchased, which I do believe my accountant has asked me to do, and I have not paid attention to it. And he didn't do it for very long, months maybe, and then he just started using it for just crazy word games, because he loved word games. But one of the things that he did write was that he bought a bird. And then there was this little bit of music in the expense book, and then a little note. And what we think is that he bought this bird because the bird sang this note of music to him. And it's very similar to a concerto that he had been working on at the time when he bought the bird, but just kind of messed up a little bit. So we think maybe, or people think, and then told me, so now I think, that the the Starling sort of jazzed up his composition, and he thought that was hilarious, and so he bought it. So I was like, oh, that sounds nice, right? A bird is a composing partner, that's not sad. But this essay ends up with both the bird and the man dead. We won't get that far. I'm just going to read that first happy 7 minutes of the essay. It's called Vogelschlag. Whistle a little Mozart to a starling in a cage. If it knows humans as creatures that sing and are sung to, the bird will shut its beak. It will arch its starling neck, bending towards your puckered lips. It might bob its back head, bob its dark head back and forth at the Mozart line you've sent out, the dotted pops of Papagena Papagino, or the crystalline shards of the rondo for glass harmonica. And though a caged starling is chatty during the day and downright garrulous at night, at the moment it locks in on your Mozartian whistle, the little bird will only blink, aiming its entire soundless self toward the music coming from you. Note how it nods along with your tuneful body as if to say, yes, yes, I have it. But a starling is no parrot. Do not expect when you whistle twinkle, twinkle, you'll immediately hear a little star in return. You have got to come back whistling for a day or 12, confirming the sound's place in the world with the bird perches. And when it does spit back whatever Mozart line you fed it, it will be on a starling's zany terms. A theme from the Hofner Symphony, punctuated with guttural warbles, or the famous adagio from his clarinet concerto, mixed into an uncanny impersonation of your dishwasher. The Queen of the Night aria, sung in a screech worthy of a Bee Gee. And a few days after that, your line of Mozart will come from the birdcage as a barely recognizable string of filched sounds, all sung together in a line so arrhythmic, it's catchy. You'll hear Mozart, your own voice, the white noise of the house you live in, plus the recesses of starling instinct. It goes a little something like this. Twinkle, zee, twink, hi, how are you? Doorbell cool, check, 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 little, weep, weep, rrr, 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 little, cranny, smoke alarm lit, hi, how are you, tall? Twinkle, little, that Bee Gees screech again, star. This will then be repeated with the maddening obsessiveness of an EDM concert. We're not sure why starlings engage in such behavior, but we think it's because this breed is hardwired to sing to its tribes. And there are many in a starling's life. The little tribe of the monogamous pair, that of the clutch family, that of the flock in the field, the mob coming home from neighboring fields to roost together overnight, and all these tribes are sonic. This sonic sense of the tribal might explain why, when we see a trilling mob of 10,000 starlings, each bird watching its seven closest neighbors for the slightest change of speed or angle, dodging hawks en masse with shrieks and chips and beep beats and hard whistles, we find ourselves calling that group not a flock or a swarm or a drove, but instead a collective noun that's drenched in sound, a murmuration. So what kind of murmur began that spring day in Vienna when a 28-year-old Mozart, jaunty in his garnet coat and gold-rimmed cap, strolled into a shop just to whistle at a starling in a cage? That bird must have zeroed in on Mozart's mouth as the man whistled a 17-note opening phrase from a recent piano concerto. And usually I can whistle, but it just occurred to me that I'm reading an essay about music in front of a really good music writer, and now my mouth is dried up, so I'm just going to sing that out rather than whistle it. I'm so excited to be reading. Anyway, so that bird must have zeroed in on Mozart's mouth as the man whistled the 17-note opening phrase from his recent piano concerto. Mozart's melody riffs in G on a simple line heard in many a German folk song, so the starling might have been hearing similar tunes from other shoppers that whole month. Or perhaps Mozart himself had been in a few times and had whistled his line enough for the bird to learn it. But no matter how the starling got the song, on May 27, 1784, it spat that tune right back at the tunesmith. But not without taking some liberties first. The little songbird unslurred the quarter notes and added a dramatic fermata at the end of the first full measure. We can only guess how long it held that first warbly G. At the next bar, it lengthened Mozart's staccato attack and replaced his effete grace notes with two pairs of bold crotchets. And then, the starling had the audacity to sharp the two G's of the second measure when any Viennese composer worth his wig would have kept them natural and in line with the key. And those bird-born G-sharps take the steady folk tune into a more harmonically complex place, ignoring the fermata natural G of the earlier measure and pushing toward the next note in the phrase, an A. which builds a lifted E major chord instead. And Mozart apparently loved this egg because he bought that bird on sight. And for good measure, he drew a little treble staff in his expense book and scored the starling's tweaks under the note of purchase. He wrote, Vogelschauer, 34 Kreutzer, ya ba 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 ba. And under the last measure, an acclamation, scribbled in the maestro's quick hand, das war schön, that was beautiful. There is no other live animal purchase in Mozart's expense book, and no more handwritten melodies, no additional transactions that were praised as schön. This is one of the very few things we even know about his purchasing habits. He'd only begun tracking his spending that year, and by late summer, Mozart had abandoned the practice and only used his notebook to magpie random phrases of English. So this note of purchase is special among the extant scraps of his life. He also bought the bird at a critical point for the classical period. At the end of the 18th century, tunes were never more sparkling or more kept, their composers obsessive over the rhetoric of sonata form, a four-part structure that permeated classical symphony, sonata, and concerto. By 1784, sonata form had imprinted itself on the listening culture enough to feel like instinct. Vienna audiences could rest comfortably in the run of classical forms as familiar, and thus enjoyable, narratives. And nobody played this cagey game more giddily than Mozart. Of all the things Johann Christoph Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart brought to human sound, the most important may be his sense of surprise. His compositions, while almost always law-abiding, are full of trickery. Leading tones that drop away from roots, accidental notes that jar the listening mind from its diverted stupor, and minuets that are too syncopated to dance to. These caprices, though stuck inside the pinfold of common practice, are what made him a star. As the old German saying goes, the music of Bach gave us God's word, Beethoven gave us God's fire, but Mozart gave God's laughter to the world. He found the accidents in song that reminded music to glorify the playful, the mischievous, the pop that sends Jack exploding from the box after so much measured cranking. So the starling's playful G sharps must have felt more than schön to the maestro and worth more to him, much more to him than 34 damn Kreutzer. Think of it. He'd whistle a tune steeped in Vienna's golden algebra to a thing with feathers, and then the animal bobbed its little head and whistled back to him a glorious, deviant, Mozartian wink. This wasn't just schön, this was game recognizing game. It's difficult to imagine a more priceless moment. One of the greatest thinkers in history, bonding with a bird brain. And I'll stop there. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you.